And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. This hour, Dr. Jeffrey Long with us, MD, leading near-death experience researcher, and he is the founder of the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation as well. More than 10 years of research gone into Dr. Long's study of more than 1,300 near-death experiences, and here he is to react to the story. Jeffrey, welcome back, first of all. How are you?
I'm doing great. Pleasure to be back, George.
Now, this study about high levels of CO2 in near-death experiencers doesn't negate the fact that there's an afterlife. They didn't go that far and say that, did they?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, the study was very tentative. As you mentioned, George, I've studied over 1,300 near-death experiences. This study involved 11 near-death experiences.
That's it?
Yep, that's totally the sum total of the study here.
Now, what does this tell you about what they were studying in the first place? I mean, the fact that there are high levels of CO2, maybe that's normal when somebody's getting close to death, huh?
Oh, absolutely. Let me talk about terms a little bit here. We're using the term CO2. That's carbon dioxide. That's a normal gas in blood, in everybody's blood. Now, when you stop breathing, when you're not exhaling carbon dioxide, which is a normal physiologic function, then carbon dioxide can build up in the blood, and you have higher levels of that particular type of gas in the blood. The study that was published today from the University of Maribor from Slovenia suggests that higher levels of carbon dioxide might be associated with near-death experience. I'm not convinced, and we'll be glad to talk about that.
Absolutely. Let's also get your views, too. You know, you have been studying near-death experience for now well over 10 years, Jeffrey. How did you get into this? What pushed you into this field?
Well, I actually first heard about near-death experience in one of the world's most prestigious journals, the Journal of the American Medical Association. I was looking for a cancer-related article and saw an article that talked about near-death experience. I was fascinated. In all my medical training, I knew that you couldn't possibly have a lucid, organized experience while unconscious or clinically dead, and yet this article talked about exactly that phenomenon. I was hooked right when I read that. And from following that, I then proceeded to study near-death experience and have been doing that, as you said, for over a decade.
All right, let's talk, if you can, about some other studies that might have gone on over the years. Wasn't there a study or there was a doctor who said that at the moment of death, the body appears to lose weight as if the soul has weight?
Yeah, you know, in the early 1900s, there was a leading researcher that suggested that perhaps the body lost a few grams of weight at the time of death, and gosh, could that possibly represent the weight of the soul? Well, actually, subsequent research following that time, including some good methodology where they carefully weighed the body when the person was close to death and then immediately following death, really did not find a drop in weight. So as best we can tell, some of the earlier studies probably represented some evaporation from the body, some loss of water. But as best we can tell, there doesn't seem to be any part of the body, that being soul or anything else, that we can weigh with any kind of instruments we have available to us today.
In your opinion, and not the physical moment of death, but in your opinion, in the metaphysical or the spiritual part of dying, what happens to someone when they're getting close to having that body stop functioning?
Well, no doubt about that. As people become close to dying, they may experience what's called deathbed visions. They may see a brilliant mystical light. They may encounter deceased relatives. They may have many of the types of elements commonly described in near-death experiences, interestingly enough. And as they progress on toward death and they actually die, and that's a time where they may experience, as the recent study described and as I've been researching, a true near-death experience.
How many people would experience that kind of a situation? If 100 people get to that kind of closure, almost, how many experience that?
Yeah, well, it's hard. Of course, among those that are permanently dead, George,
we don't know that.
Yeah. We really don't know. They make very difficult subjects to fill out questionnaire forms. So the best evidence that we have are those that clinically die. Their heart may stop, their breathing may stop, and yet they survive this close brush with death, come back, and are able to tell us about what they experienced at that point in time. Among those that have had cardiac arrest, in other words, their heart stops, around 10 to 23% will have near-death experiences.
Would you say that's a high percent, Jeffrey?
Well, it's a surprisingly low percentage in my point of view. Ah. I mean, that suggests the great majority of people that nearly die, that whose heart stops, don't have a near-death experience.
And I wonder why.
You know, we don't really know. There's been over 35 years of scholarly near-death experience research. People have looked at every possible correlate with why people have near-death experiences and why don't when they come to that critical time where their heart stops and they just about die. And yet, to the best of the scholarly research that we have, all prior studies that have been done, we really don't know. And furthermore, we cannot predict who will have a near-death experience at that time and who will not.
Are there levels of severity with near-death experiences? I mean, can one say this person had a near-fatal heart attack, but this person had a heart attack, but it wasn't as bad?
Oh, sure. It's when people come close to death, there's all sorts of things that can happen. They can come close to death, their heart may beat irregularly, and yet it may still be pumping blood. And yet there's that time when the heart absolutely stops beating, when the measurements of electrical activity of the heart are flatlining or have such an irregular electrical activity that no possible ability of the heart to pump blood is being measured. So there's a whole spectrum of these types of close brushes with death that have been documented.
You speak to a lot of people. You are the founder of the Near Death Experience Research Foundation. People come up to you and say, Dr. Long, is there life after death? What do you tell them, Jeffrey?
You know, that happens a lot, George, especially in my medical specialty where I treat patients that have a critical illness like cancer and where they face a life-threatening illness where they know that or their loved one or themselves may die as a result of their outcome. More and more, I think, as people talk more and more about death, as there's more openness about that, I'm seeing more people now than ever before that are comfortable sharing with me about their concerns about death, their awareness about my work in near-death experience, and their awareness and the research that I've done that suggests strongly that there is really life after death. And I think that really helps my patients to face their cancer courageously. I think it helps them to make the right decisions for what they want to do when they face that end-of-life decisions. And I know, certainly personally, it helps me to be a better doctor for them.
Well, I've got to tell you, Jeffrey, you were one of those, and I'm not even sure you know this, that got me to kick one of my phobias, and that was the phobia of when you go to sleep, you may die in your sleep, and how horrible that would be. Now, the longer I would think of that, the more nuttier I'd get. And all of a sudden, when you were on with us in January and previous shows, I realized that, number one, if there is no life after death, and I happen to believe there is, but if there is no life after death and you go in your sleep, you're not going to know about it, so don't worry about it. And two, if there is life after death, you're going to continue on anyways, so don't worry about it either. And it took a while to get over that.
Wow, you know, that I think that's very insightful, George, exactly what you just said. You know, you're right. I mean, if there's no life after death, you don't worry. If there is life after death, you don't have to worry. And yet every shred of evidence that we're getting with near-death experience, all prior research and multiple other researchers all finding the same thing is that there is life after death, that there's a wonderful life after death. It's for you, George. It's for me. It's for every listener. It's for all of us. A life after death that's wonderful, and that's every shred of research that I've done and others have done all consistently point to that profound, that extremely important, and that extremely hopeful message.
Jeffrey, are there other cultures that are more active in promoting near-death experiences and life after death as opposed to maybe like a Western culture?
You know, that's a good question. I think here in the Western cultures and certainly here in the United States, there's a lot more interest about near-death experience. The people are interested in it. They're aware of it in the media. They're aware of it in the shows like this. And so as a result of that, people are asking questions. They study it. They learn about it. They become aware of it if they've experienced it or somebody that they know has experienced it. And I think that there's probably more awareness here in the United States than most other places. But having said that, certainly in other cultures, other non-Western cultures, there may be an increased openness to the concept of talking about death. There may be less fear about death because there's more openness. There's more awareness that death is a natural endpoint of life. There's more awareness and acceptance of an afterlife. And so I think in these other cultures, there may actually be, if anything, an increased acceptance of near-death experience.
What about religions? I would assume almost all religions promote and talk about, after-death experiences.
You know, for thousands of years, the great religions have been delivering a consistent message, and that is we don't really die, that there's life after death, a wonderful life after death, a heaven, the beautiful realms. And what's incredible is the near-death experience research that I've done is consistently pointing to saying, yeah, that which mankind had to take on faith for thousands of years, now all of a sudden we can say, hey, it's beyond just what you take on faith. It seems to be reality. It seems to be something we can study scientifically. And extremely importantly, life after death seems to be real.
Are we teaching our children about these experiences?
You know, we should be. We're not teaching them nearly enough. Still in this culture here, in the United States and in other areas around the world, death is a little bit taboo. In other words, people are hesitant to tell their children about death, to talk about that, to be open about that. People still somewhat shun talking about death, even when someone in the family, say a grandparent or somebody who's up in age is facing a life-threatening event or dying. There really still needs to be more openness. There still needs to be that awareness that death is a part of life. It's the end part of life, and it's a part. It's something we're all going to have to go through, and you know, especially with near-death experience research and some of the new findings that were coming out that we have in afterlife. I think now more than ever, it's important to start talking more about death, not in terms of the fright of death, the finality of death, but in terms of the optimism, the positivity, the evidence that we have that death is not final and that there's much, much more to our life after death.
How does a parent know when, if at all, to take a child to a funeral home?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Wow, you know, I've been a parent, and there's no good answer to that. Very difficult. I think a lot of it depends on parental instinct. I mean, sometimes parents just simply know. I mean, they may know not to take the child to a funeral. They may say it's time to. But I think above and beyond that, certainly if the child is asking, as a parent, you don't want to let your own concerns, fears, or biases about death interfere with what your child really needs in their life. In other words, if the child is asking about death, if the child seems to be okay talking about death, then that child is probably ready to go to that funeral. That child is probably ready to talk about death and to understand death, you know, maybe even at a higher level than the parents themselves.
And then again, if the child talks to the grandmother who's departed, you know you're onto something there, too.
Oh, you are, too. And that's called an after-death communication, and that's certainly a part of the area of research that I've been involved with, and that's an absolutely real phenomenon as well.
What's new with some of your work, Jeffrey?
Well, of course, I, in January, published a book, Evidence of the Afterlife, The Science of Near-Death Experiences. Good gosh, within 8 days, it was a New York Times bestseller. The amount of communication I've received from that has just been mammoth. People are absolutely astounded. It's been an incredibly positive impact on a vast number of people that have read that book, that become aware of this research. A very, very consistent message from my research indicating that near-death experiences, consistently with 9 lives of evidence that I point out in that book, consistently pointing to the fact that we really do have an afterlife. It really is a afterlife beyond anything I think we can possibly imagine in our earthly life. It's for all of us, and it is, I mean, wonderful is too mild of a word. It is incredible.
Absolutely. Well, you stick with us, Jeffrey. When we return in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM, we are going to take phone calls with you. So we shall be right back on Coast to Coast. Don't touch your dial. Well, I was 18 when I went to my very first funeral home. My high school friend Steve Balog had passed away. He died in a car crash. He was a passenger in one of those little Volkswagen Beetles and got into a head-on collision, and he went right out through the windshield and died instantly. And we all went to the funeral. Yeah, all of us. We had just graduated from high school. He was going into the Air Force. And man, that was something. That was very, very, very weird for all of us. We'll take your phone calls with Dr. Jeffrey Long in just a moment. And if you want to share some of those experiences with us, go right ahead. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're with Dr. Jeffrey Long, and let's go to the phones. Here we go. Let's go to I'm a Ohio John in east of the Rockies. Go ahead, John.
Hi, good morning, George and Dr. Long.
Morning.
Good morning.
Morning. I had a couple of questions for you in regards to, are you familiar with the little boy that drowned in his mother's bathtub, and they used a hypothermic state to preserve his brain function, and then brought him back, and he's completely fine right now.
Yeah, and, uh-huh.
Yeah, and I thought of George's friend that suffered the spinal cord injury as well, because they're using hypothermia. But my question is there a difference in a near-death experience with and without a hypothermic state?
Yeah, that's a good question, John. Near-death experiences occur under all circumstances of nearly dying. I've certainly heard a lot of experiences where people, say, fell through the ice and in frozen ponds, frozen lakes, and were ultimately resuscitated and had a near-death experience. As best we can tell, there doesn't seem to be any association with the content of near-death experiences, whether or not they had that kind of hypothermia, either associated with the near-death experience circumstances itself or when used as part of resuscitation. And by the way, hypothermia means lowering the body temperature, and you're describing a recently described new phenomenon, how to bring back people that have had a heart attack where they actually lower the body temperature through a variety of artificial means, and yet that seems to help increase the probability of patients surviving heart attacks.
Yeah, it's a fantastic area of research. I wanted to ask Christian Wild if he had looked into that.
I will do that. Go ahead,
yeah.
Jeffrey.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no doubt about that. I think there's going to be more people that are going to be saved that will survive life-threatening events, especially heart attacks, with this new technology of resuscitation. No doubt about that. I think as time goes on, we're going to have more people describing near-death experiences because they were saved than we've ever had in the past.
Okay, next up, we go to the Big Island of Hawaii. HD, take it away. Hi there.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
15 years ago or more, I saw a program about death, and it was on a 2020 or one of these magazine news TV programs. The program was about death, and on that program, a hospital psychologist repeatedly was getting these near-death experience relations from people out of the OR. And so she asked other colleagues in the business if they were getting reports of it. Yeah, it happens every time, every day. So they did a little experiment. They put one of those lighted LED lighted message boards on top of a cabinet in the OR, and they'd play some crazy message on there, like take the possum out of the refrigerator. Every time one of these people came and explained how they were floating above their body and saw everything, they said, "Well, did you see anything unusual?" And not one person actually saw what was real, that message on top of the cabinet. Now, in your first appearance in January, I almost put my finger out trying to get through. My question is, you never cited any research to the contrary of your hypothesis, and you consistently referred to the scientific method. What thousands of experiments with the same result have you done to prove your hypothesis?
Yeah, good question, HD. You know, of course, I've studied over 1,400 near-death experiences, so we've certainly looked at a lot of those types of experiences. The types of experiments that you're talking about are the so-called prospective studies where they place targets. A very common phenomenon, about 45% of near-death experiences have an out-of-body experience early on during their near-death experience. Their consciousness rises above their body and from often ceiling level or around that level. They see their own body, and often the frantic resuscitation efforts going on at the time of their life-threatening event. Now, there's been five separate prospective studies where they've placed targets. And there's been about a dozen patients that had near-death experiences at the time of these studies where there were targets placed, but HD, not a single one of these studies involved someone having a near-death experience where their point of consciousness, in other words, where they were looking or where they were aware of, was directed toward that target. So, of course, none of them, as a result, saw what was on the message and the target. The bottom line is we need to continue that kind of research, and there's actually a major study called the AWARE study, A-W-A-R-E, ongoing in many, many hospitals, and hopefully we'll have that addressed when we get results from that study in the years to come. An intriguing line of research, no doubt about that.
And, Jeffrey, does anybody listen to doctors and nurses, those who are attending people who truly pass on and they see the, the ectoplasm rising out of the body, the soul perhaps?
Yeah, you know, that's been very commonly described, certainly in the spectrum of near-death experiences around the time. It's interesting, people over and over, loved ones, family members, friends that are with those that are dying, will periodically describe, if you will, a light, a presence, or they may even actually sense the departure of something with the person who's dying and how it departs the body. And typically that's associated with the actual moment of death. So absolutely, that's been observed consistently.
Ziegler, Illinois, welcome to Coast, Jerry, go ahead.
Good morning. When I was 10 years old, my grandmother passed away. And the day of her funeral, that evening I could not sleep. And so I went out into the living room and laid in front of our furnace, an old stokomatic coal stove. And I seen my mother walk out of her bedroom, and I didn't want to startle her, so I yelled, "Mom," just to let her know I was there. She continued to walk, and I yelled "Mom" a couple times. She stood in front of me and then turned and went to my sister's bedroom, and then came back to me, and that time I yelled "Mom" very loudly, and I heard my mom say "What" from her bedroom. To this day, I believe that was my grandmother saying, you know, doing one last check on us, one last check of her grandkids. Also, when I was 12, I was caught in a house fire, and this gives me goosebumps to think about it. I was caught in a room, and I was standing in the corner screaming for my dad. The room was in complete flames, and my dad didn't live with us, and I was screaming with my dad, and then all of a sudden, I could see me. I mean, I was like looking down at me, and I spoke, and I said, "If you leave now, you'll only be burnt. If you leave now, you'll only be burnt." And that caused me to start feeling my way along the wall until I could find a door and get out of the room. I don't know if those are near death or after death or what you would call it, but those are both very true incidents that happened when I was a kid.
Yeah, wow. Thanks for sharing that, Jerry. I mean, all of us can just feel the intensity, the emotion, amazing those experiences have been to you. With regard to your grandmother after she died and you saw that entity, that's probably what's called an after-death communication, and that's not at all unusual for people actually see, hear, or sense the deceased. And that's been well described in a variety of circumstances, dreams or non-dream states. The second experience where you were calling out for your dad and you describe seeing yourself, that's probably what we call a fear-death experience. Again, related to near-death experiences, it sounds like you had your consciousness apart from your body and out-of-body experience. No doubt about that, that was part of the real spectrum of these very real types of experiences that we know, and that's I could just sense how dramatic that was to you. Thanks for sharing that, Jerry.
Yeah, have a good night.
You too.
All right, Jerry, thank you. Next up we go to Dave, first-time caller in Chicago, Illinois. Hi, David.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi. Well, my friend's mom, I'm not specifically sure what she does, but she takes care of old people. And on multiple occasions, the people have died while she's been there. And she swears by the fact that when there's like people emit a smell when they're going to die, like whether it be a few hours or like a day, she kind of swears by this. And I was wondering if you ever heard anything like this before.
You know, that's interesting. And I've even heard of some people describe how pets or animals seem to have a sense of impending death. It means it's going to happen in the near future. It's a relatively rare phenomenon, David, and really not a lot of scholarly research done about that. It may well be in the spectrum of something that we need to learn a heck of a lot more about than we know right now. Interesting.
Is that something that you think like maybe just she could do, or is that something that people do when they're going to die?
it's probably just something that she can do. It'd be interesting for her to try to document that and learn more about that and try to get a clear sense for just how reliable her sense is with that, because that's such a rare phenomenon, and we know so little about that. The more information we can get about that, the more anybody tries to study that, the more we'll all learn and know in the future.
Awesome. Well, that's good advice.
Yeah, super.
All right. Thank you, David. Are there other doctors, Jeffrey, that you feel as if they are doing just a tremendous job studying near-death experiences?
Oh, yes. You know, as time goes on, more and more people are learning more about near-death experiences, interested in doing more about near-death experience research. There's really a number of doctors here in the United States and around the world that are studying near-death experiences. We have Dr. Sam Parnia, who's doing the so-called prospective study, where they're placing those targets around areas of the hospital where people may die, and hoping that people can actually see these targets and bring back a report so we can assess how accurate out-of-body observations are. I can tell you from my research, I'm virtually certain they're going to be incredibly accurate based on all the accounts I've heard. And lots of other doctors, too, all around. Lots more scholarly research going on. Year by year, we're learning more about near-death experience than we knew before, and the results are exciting.
Let's go next to Mike in Kentucky, east of the Rockies. Hey, Michael, go ahead.
Good morning. I have been infected with HIV for 15 years. Right now, my health is very good, thanks to the fact that I have extremely good doctors. 5 years ago, I had a younger brother who died of the same illness. About 6 months after he died, I was taking some very, very powerful pharmaceutical painkillers, and I had accidentally mixed some antihistamine, over-the-counter antihistamines with it, and I ended up in the hospital emergency room. The doctors told me that if they had been 15 minutes later getting me to the emergency room, that I would not have survived. During this time that I was comatose, everything was totally black. I saw absolutely nothing. When I came to in the emergency room, the nurse was looking at me, and she just was sort of taken aback, my eyes open, and she said, "Whoa," like she wasn't expecting me to ever regain consciousness. And I was wondering, you know, what is going on that I did not have a near-death experience?
Yeah, sure. You know, and that's a good question, Mike, and that's something that near-death experience researchers wrestle with. You are like the great majority of people. In other words, only about 10 to 20% of people who nearly die have a near-death experience. So that means about 80 to 90% of people, just like you, Mike, do not have a near-death experience. In over 35 years of research on near-death experience, no researcher has been able to identify with any certainty or be able to predict, if you will, at the time of a life-threatening event, who's going to have a near-death experience, or among those that have a near-death experience, what the content will be. It's one of the great mysteries and one of the great, if you will, open areas for future near-death experience research. We simply can't understand that. I will say, as a matter of reassurance, Mike, that people that have had near-death experiences, when they come back almost uniformly, they believe that the heavenly realms that they've encountered, that their understanding that there's life after death, their understanding how connected we all are, they really almost uniformly believe that that afterlife, that wonderful afterlife, is not just for those that have near-death experiences, but is for all of us.
By the way, Jeffrey, I want to congratulate you on your compassion with people that you deal with on a regular basis. I mean, you have a true sensitivity for that.
Well, you know, I really appreciate that. And the interesting thing is, you know, my research in near-death experience, I said earlier, it's made me a better doctor, but I think that's one of the focal areas that it's really made a difference. I'm more compassionate with people. I listen more.
Yeah.
I really enjoy being with other people more. And there's no doubt about that. I think people that have had a near-death experience, that study near-death experiences, that are interested, I think it really changes you over time, and you really become a more positive, optimistic person. And it certainly helped me to be a better doctor, helping to be there for people facing these life-threatening illnesses.
Let's go to Fair Oaks, California, on the Skype line. Killian, go ahead. There you go.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm Killian Phillips. I'm 20 years old. I'm sure that I'm among the younger of your listeners.
You're right. You're right in there. We've had some 12-year-olds call, believe it or not, Killian, but go ahead.
First off, I'd like to say that I applaud all physicians and practitioners. In my mind, doctors are among the most important people in our society. And you sound like a very intelligent and educated individual. So when I say this, I mean absolutely no offense. However, I believe that arguments of philosophy should remain in the realm of philosophy and should not be touted or promoted by science, you know, quote, science, as science is inherently agnostic when it comes or in regards to all things supernatural.
You know, Killian, I totally agree with you. When I study near-death experience, it's not a matter of philosophy. It's not what I want to believe or based on pre-existing beliefs. It's a study of over 1,400 near-death experiences, and they actually fill out a very detailed, scientifically developed questionnaire of 150 questions. So, you know, what the research I do when I come up with this conclusions that I do, really not based on philosophy, it's really based on evidence.
Absolutely. A couple minutes to go. Let's go to Vicki in Orange County, California. Go ahead, Vicki.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I had a near-death experience. I was in labor with my third child. This was back in 59.
Uh-huh.
And I was in heavy labor, and my kids were close together. Like they were. This was my third child, and they were like one, two, three. Anyway, as I was in labor, I experienced going into the white light. And I was going down the tunnel, and I knew what was happening. It was, you know, it was brilliantly lit. And I almost reached a level. I could see just a little. I didn't go all the way, but I could see a little bit above, like I was coming onto, like another floor, like you're on an elevator. And I knew what was happening, and I asked to come back and not go on because I didn't want to leave my children. And I shot back.
And here you are.
Yes, but it was an incredible experience. I knew. It was such a peaceful feeling.
I'll bet you had overwhelming feelings of peace and love, like so many near-death experiencers describe, Vicki. Is that right? And you know, no doubt about that. That is a typical white light, a mystical light, very commonly described in near-death experiences.
But, you know, it was strange, too. I knew exactly what was happening. And like I say, I even had, you know, the sense about me to ask to come back and stay with my children.
Oh, a lot of people are aware of what's going on when this happens.
No doubt about that. And it's, you know, when you feel those overwhelming feelings of peace and love and joy, a lot of people during a near-death experience say that what they're experiencing in these unearthly, if you will, heavenly realms, they have a sense that that's their real home, and it's very, they're very quick to say, gosh, the earthly life that I've known for years, decades of their life isn't really the real home. It's those unearthly, heavenly realms that's their real home. We hear that over and over, Vicki.
Jeffrey, I want to thank you for spending the hour with us, my friend, and stay in touch with us, okay?
We absolutely. It's been a great pleasure, George. Thank you so much.
It's Dr. Jeffrey Long, who is reacting to a story about near-death experiences explained by high levels of CO2, not so in terms of what's really going on.